Schönen Nachmittag bei einer Folge der Philosophischen Brocken. Am Mikrofon ist Herbert Rachowitz. Wir bringen diesmal eine editierte Fassung einer Podiumsdiskussion, die ein wenig mehr als ein Jahr alt ist. Sie hat stattgefunden während des Wittgenstein-Symposions 2007. Das war ein Symposium, das gewidmet war der Philosophie der Informationsgesellschaft, und in diesem Podium haben einige Vortragende dieses Symposiums Fragen des Publikums beantwortet. Am Podium saßen Cameron McEwan, Alan Rainier, Anat Bilecki, Jos de Mull, Charles S., Juliette Floyd und Luciano Floridi. Die Diskussion ist ausgesprochen spannend verlaufen, auch kontrovers, und hat drei Teile. Der erste Teil beschäftigte sich mit einem Thema, das während des Symposiums mehrfach diskutiert worden ist, nämlich mit der Frage, ob Information direkt etwas mit Wahrheit zu tun hat. Das war eine These, die der Keynote-Speaker Fred Dretsky aufgestellt hat und mit der Alois Pichler, der mit mir die Podiumsdiskussion moderierte, die Auseinandersetzung begonnen hat. Luciano Floridi hat die Position Dretskys nochmal unterstrichen und damit eine kontroverse Debatte ausgelöst, die einen Zug hat, der in philosophischen Debatten mehrfach und immer wieder zum Ausdruck kommt, nämlich man stellt allgemeine Aussagen auf, diese allgemeinen Aussagen treffen auf Widerspruch, und wenn dieser Widerspruch wahrgenommen und diskutiert wird, reduziert man die Allgemeinheit der Aussage auf kleinere Fachbereiche. In dem speziellen Fall hat Luciano Floridi unterschieden zwischen drei Arten von Information, nämlich einer Information für etwas, wie zum Beispiel einem Rezept für eine Speise, einer Information als etwas, wie zum Beispiel Fingerabdrücke oder geologische Formationen, die als Fakten etwas darstellen, was Information beinhaltet, und drittens semantische Information, die etwas mit der behaupteten Wirklichkeit zu tun hat. Er hat dann die allgemeine These, Information ist wahrheitsorientiert, beschränkt auf die dritte, die semantische Form. Der zweite Hauptteil der Diskussion ist dann ausgelöst worden von Michael Maurer, einem Philosophiestudenten aus Wien, und er hat eine Frage ins Auditorium gestellt, nämlich wie denn Wittgenstein mit seinem durchaus antimodernistischen Philosophieren zu einer Themenstellung wie Informationsgesellschaft gestanden wäre. Im Anschluss an mehrere Antworten auf diese Frage ist dann der dritte Teil entstanden, und der beschäftigt sich ganz allgemein mit Positionen, Möglichkeiten, Gefahren von Philosophie angesichts dieser sozial-politisch-historischen Umwälzung, die wir als Wissensgesellschaft oder Informationsgesellschaft bezeichnen.
You are the ones who are going to ask the questions, so we are going to start with questions of the audience. You have been here for 1 week, you have accumulated, I'm quite certain, a lot of questions, and the panel will be here and will be happy to answer this. Now, I do not think I'll have to introduce each panelist by their own achievements. It's Cameron McEwan, it's Alan Rainier, Anat Bilecki, Jos de Mull, Juliet Floyd, Charles S., and Luciano Floridi. So I hope in doing it like this, we can draw off some of their expertise, starting from your questions.
I would like to start, and I wonder very much about the following. We have had this discussion about the concept of information, whether it is neutral to truth and falsehood, or whether it includes truth. As Professor Dretzky said in the opening lecture, information is only information if it is true information. So I would like to ask the panel, what do we win, what do we lose, if we consider the concept of information, if we conceive of it as neutral to truth, falsehood, and what do we win, lose if we don't? And I seem to remember that Luciano Floridi at the conference, at the lecture in Bergen, showed tendencies to, or was very sympathetic to including truth into the concept of information. So only true information is information. What is the answer?
Well, after so many expectations being vented, I'm delighted to start this discussion. Now, yes, indeed, I completely agree with Fred Dresky. Information, anything that qualifies as information, as semantic information, has to be true. I know that not everybody agrees here about that. In fact, there are even some philosophers. Yes, and there are even some philosophers who disagree. Now, there are. I don't want to take too much time, so I can give you a short list of why you should change your mind if you don't believe that. And the list includes at least four reasons. The reason number one: there is a perfectly good model logic which shows that in order to have semantic information, you have to include, as one of the axioms, truthfulness. If you want to know more about it, I'll tell you in a moment. It's model logic, it's a normal model logic B. You know, S4, S5, that kind of stuff. So there's a model logic that makes it perfectly fine. Misinformation would become inexplicable unless you start saying that misinformation is not information because it's false. A misinformation is like a false policeman, not a policeman. Not someone who is a policeman, but a false policeman is not a policeman. False information means that it is not information. Reason number three, we're almost there. There's a paradox which you can solve only if, and it's an important paradox, is the Bahilo-Carnap paradox, which you can solve only if you include, as one of the conditions for to count as information, the veridicality, the truthfulness of it, more of it if you want to know about it. And there's a fourth reason, which is in pragmatics, even colleagues who have done completely different work in linguistics on theory of relevance, they assume that for something to count as information, it has to be true. So something counts as information if it is true, which therefore counts as relevant, which therefore provides a ground for a theory of meaning. So you have four different reasons, one logical, one from information theory, the paradox, one from linguistics, theory of relevance, and one from ordinary language, misinformation, which point all in the same direction. If you're still unconvinced, the ball is definitely...
I would want to ask a question of clarification, and perhaps Luciano has changed his mind. But if all information is by definition true, and if in an information ontology all existent beings are information, then it would seem that we must live in a universe of truth and nothing but truth. But this does not seem to be the universe I'm living in. Is this my problem?
Thanks, Charles. Now, what is missing is an initial distinction. There are many ways in which we speak about information. Normally, there are three fundamental ways. Information as something, information about something, information for something. An algorithm, a recipe, is information for something. You ask your mom how to cook a particular cake. She gives you the information. That cake, cooking, is information, but it's an algorithm. It's information for something. You ask the train table, is information about something. When does the train leave? at such and such time. That's the semantic information we're talking about. Then this information as something, your fingerprints, your DNA, that's what Charles is talking about. If entities are informational, then you have this ontological understanding. It has got nothing to do with truth, so let's not get confused.
Fred is sitting there. Have you had any afterthoughts after your talk on Monday?
I would simply add something I failed to mention Monday, that we certainly do talk about false information, and I was asked how one would account for that if information has to be true. I would account for it the same way we talk of fake diamonds, which aren't real diamonds. To talk of false information is just to talk about fake information, something that purports to be information that is not, just like a fake diamond might purport to be a diamond, but it's not a diamond. I wouldn't conclude from the fact that there are fake diamonds that there are some diamonds that are made of plaster. I would simply conclude that fake diamonds aren't diamonds. And I wouldn't conclude from the fact that there's false information, that some information doesn't have to be true. I would simply conclude that false information isn't information.
I'm coming from outer left field for one moment, and I'd like to put in the human element in this whole story. Either we're not using the word information in the same way, and I realize that perhaps given the context of this conference, I should just get up and go and say, okay, then my information is not your information. But in my other life, I was chair of something called B'Tselem, the Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, blah, blah, blah. Now, the whole point is to get information. The more information we have, and that information does come, a lot of it, via computers, the more information we have, the more problems we have, but we don't say that any of it is fake. And we don't think of it, we do find it contradictory sometimes, and we have to have the human element in there to estimate which parts of the information are true, true according to who has put what emphasis on what. Information is a much richer concept in that sense than the way you've been using the word. So I might be out of context here, and then if I am, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm also not very inclined to agree with the notion that only true information can be termed information. I think when we talk about information, we might distinguish three levels, a syntactic level, and I think when you talk about the more chaotic it is, the more information it has, is a kind of syntactical notion, like we find it with Shannon, for example. You have the semantic level, and you have a pragmatic level. And I think perhaps on the level of syntactics, you can defend this thesis. But when semantics involved, you already had the problems. And let's take one of the examples of Fred Dretzke during his talk. He says, when I say I am in Kirchberg at this moment, that's information which is true. And you also refer to when somebody says Kirchberg is north of Vienna, then it's no information. That there happens also to be a Kirchberg north of Vienna, I heard. That's one of the points. But let's suppose that we are in Kosovo. And somebody says, I am in Kosovo. And another person says, we are in Serbia. Social fact. I think then we already have much more difficulty in this notion of information is true. Then interpretation comes in and context comes in. And then we also have the pragmatic dimension coming in here. So I think on the syntactic level, I think there is you can make a case for it. But as soon as semantics and pragmatics are involved, then this is very problematic to take this position.
Yeah, I thought I would practice the method of the Tractatus, which is to wait till someone else speaks. Demonstrate I have a sign, no bedeutung. No, I think truth is very important, and the distinction between correctness and incorrectness, building that in makes perfect sense to me. In that sense, I guess I come out of the Frege tradition. But of course, if we have norms of validity and norms of truth and so on, I take what I learned from Wittgenstein to be something more of what's being emphasized here, that, you know, there's a lot of truth out there. The point is, who are we informing of this, and on what occasion? And particularly with the web, how do we organize it, and so on and so forth? So I would only add that the pragmatics affect how important we think it is to analyze a concept of information with the notion of truth built in, because language does not apply itself. So that would be, I guess, my point.
So we could have never planned it like this. One question, and everyone on the panel is going to answer. So this is one more of those answers, but then we'll actually switch back to the audience.
Okay, so I'm certainly on the information entails truth side, but stepping back a bit, it's not, I would say, maybe in an un-Wittgensteinian vein, it's not about the word information or concern, it's about a particular concept, or a number of concepts. One of them is, it maps fairly well under the use of the English word information. And from that perspective, any effort to find a decisive counterexample in ordinary usage is always going to be deviled by idioms, irony, and Gricean rules of conversation discourse. So we have to look at the phenomenon of ordinary usage in kind of in the right spirit, because you're always going to find a case that's ironic, that's idiomatic, or where there's a Gricean explanation for why you feel there was something out of order.
Very clear example of common usage is he gave me, or the travel bureau gave me, the wrong information, and I don't think you have to analyze it. Everybody understands it, and in my mind they're just two ways of using the term legitimately. One is coupled to truth, that information is only if it's true. And the other one is a message, or someone told you something and it turned out to be wrong. And that's the other legitimate use of the term. So that solves that problem. And now you said, especially on a syntactic level, it makes sense to make truth a requirement. I think that's totally wrong, because what you were referring to was Shannon's idea that less likely message carries more information. That's the syntactic level, and Shannon's idea is just one that is totally separate from the notion of truth. It's nothing to do with truth.
There's a question that I've been meaning to ask all week. I've heard a number of talks that refer to truth, and actually you have just done this. I'm sorry, I can't remember who said there's a lot of truth out there. I have no idea what that means, because to me, truth is just a relation between a belief and a fact. So it would have been great, and actually many of us have speculated about what Professor Gretzky meant by truth, because I'm sorry, Professor Gretzky, you did not say what your assumptions were for, you know, what truth is. So if you could just state what your understanding of truth is. Is it a correspondence theory? Is it, you know, that would be great, because I've been confused all week.
I think you're not the only one. Again, I guess I, in a way, come out of the Frege tradition. Frege held the truth was indefinable. And there are various arguments about why Frege says this. One attitude one could have is that it's such a deep norm, so much connected with so many things we want to talk about. So I'm not inclined to talk of facts. I'm influenced enough by Quine that I'm very dubious of that sort of picture. It doesn't mean I'm a coherentist, and I would not follow someone like Peirce, who said it's, you know, agreement in the long run, because I think in the long run we're all dead and so on. But, you know, I think philosophers, there are various aspects to this notion, very formalist aspects, various interesting semantical aspects, various applications of the metamathematics of the notion of truth that are quite real. But I think looking for an account or a definition of this, as if we know that it's a predicate that applies to a certain sort of thing, at least arguing inductively from the history of philosophy, I myself am very skeptical whether that's the right thing to do. But I would say no one has a definition of truth. That's my view.
I think it's remarkable that we spent the first half hour on truth, but time is up for truth. And I'd encourage you to come up with some other remarks, perhaps August Fink.
I could make out two main topics in this meeting. The bigger one was that most of the papers dealt with the use of the new media, of the digital media for communication, with all the consequences and ethical problems and so on, and the changes in our social life. The second topic was how the methods of philosophical research may change by this technology, for instance, electronic editions of Wittgenstein or other philosophers. And in this last respect, I think the revolution coming up by the digital turn was in other sciences, in natural sciences, medical sciences, technical science, much more dramatic than in philosophy. And I think this would be, what would have been, an interesting topic for such a meeting, to make reflections, science theoretical reflections about these revolutions that are not located only inside these sciences, the single sciences, but mean a revolution of our whole life.
You said there were two subjects here. One was the digital itself, and the other what has happened in philosophy apropos the digital. But I think there was a third subject, and perhaps even a fourth, but the third was philosophy of information, philosophy of the digital, and that is what philosophers might be interested in, not only in the very, very localized and perhaps important question of what has happened to philosophy on the net, to philosophy in digitization, etc., but what do we think as philosophers of what is going on, of concepts as people who do conceptual analysis, and that's why we ask about the concept of information. And then the fourth thing, of course, is what Wittgenstein is doing in all of this, but that, let's say I put him aside for a moment, even though that's not very fair. Now, philosophy of information, I think there is a lot to do, and that connects with the first comment. There's a lot to do when you ask about philosophy of information, and I would not put down the kind of answers we're getting here. I think what we need to do is debate those questions as philosophers. Now, the fact that it is fruitful, or the fact that you get computers working better, or the fact that you can predict statistics, you can do all sorts of things, is something that we have to think about when we're philosophers. What is the meaning of that? And let me just say one last thing. I think the most important, again, to me only, the most important thing is, of course, what are the ethical implications of that? What does that entail? Ethically, does it entail anything? Perhaps you could always have the answer that it doesn't entail anything ethically, that as Newton said, ethics is in one place, or politics is in one place, and information and all the rest of it is somewhere else. So even that, all of that is what I think of as philosophy of what we're doing when we ask about information.
As a bit of a follow-up, I would simply call your attention. There has been in North America since the late 1980s, actually an organization that sponsors a conference every year on computing and philosophy. It's devoted to all aspects of the computational turn. There is an international association of computing and philosophy, and we have a website, ia-cap.org. I'm sitting next to the president of that organization, but he didn't want me to say that. If you look at the literature that's been generated, I would commend it to you. It has covered ethics, it has covered logic, it has covered computer-assisted instruction, philosophy of information, artificial intelligence, and philosophy of computing science, just to name a few. There's also a European CAP that just took place in Twente. There will be another one next year in Montpellier. So I would invite If you're interested in that, in terms of that thread of development, I would invite your participation and conversation with that body of literature and philosophers.
Yeah. It may be a joke, maybe, but I think the most important criteria of information is that it saves money or energy. So the truth value of information is whether it allows you to save energy. And that's why I miss also in one aspect is the huge financial streams that are all organized by information. That is the truth value of information from my point. I come from biology, and we know that living systems do everything to use information to save energy. And that's why every reform of, energy discussions is always a misdevelopment. So if living systems are asked, any increase of energy is a misdevelopment. It has to be an increase in information.
A diagram, I want to show it to you. It shows the growth of internet in the last decade of the 20th century.
Okay, can the panel see? The growth of the
growth internet? Growth of internet searches in the last decade.
Usership.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, in the last decade of the 20th century. And I remembered a quote from Wittgenstein. I have been translating it into English 5 minutes after before this kind of discussion was starting, so it's a rough translation. I'll tell you. This book is written for those who face the spirit in which it is written in a friendly way. This spirit is different from the spirit of the big current of the European and American civilization. This expresses itself in a progress in the building of always bigger and more complex structures, the other one in a quest for clarity and transparency of whatever structure. This one wants to receive the world in its periphery and the other one in its center. Don't you think that the development of our information society in the Western world, because we have no one here from Africa this year, and I think this tells a lot. So don't you think that development of our information society in the Western world is running exactly in the opposite direction of where Wittgenstein's philosophical activity was directed?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Has our conference here in Kirchberg been trying to receive the world in its periphery or in its center? Thank you.
Thank you very much for this question. Actually, you have enforced a point made by Anat in passing, namely what's the relationship, since this is a Wittgenstein symposium, what's the relationship of Wittgenstein to all of these issues? And I do have a bad conscience in some way that this has not been addressed directly, or at least very seldomly, and it's really a difficult task. And I'll have to add something more. Part of the answer, of course, is pure administration. It is that there is a Wittgenstein society that opens up to other topics, and then the other topic is not supposed to be something that Wittgenstein was very approving of. A part of it is just a matter of finance, to put it very bluntly. But since we are philosophers, that's not something that we can be satisfied with, probably you had something in mind when you mentioned this problem earlier.
I just wanted to say that obviously I think the question is a good one. I think it's more or less the question I was raising a minute ago, but in fairness to Wittgenstein, we need to realize that part of what he was talking about there was clarity, and clarity in itself, for its own sake. And your question involves questions like the opposite, or words and phrases like the exact opposite direction. A lot of thought would have to go into what is meant by direction and opposite and exact in phrases like that.
I can't believe I'm going to try with this. You left out one part of the quote, which is he does say this civilization in which we all stand. He's here too, right? So he's not saying in that draft that he's not standing here. But one metaphor he had in his lectures at Cambridge is there's been sort of a kink, right, in the history of philosophy. And he makes this very nice remark, there used to be great philosophers, now there are clever ones. Of course, this is a little bit of kitsch, right, his way. But, I mean, I think it is sort of a problem what philosophy departments are doing. And, you know, finding meaning in one's life is not a trivial matter. Now, I have no idea how the internet is going to impact on this very human sort of a problem. I think some of the problems that your talk was connecting with are connected with this. But certainly in the spirit of caution, you know, we can't forget that Wittgenstein in that sense has a very ancient view of what philosophy should do, should help you in your life. So I think in that sense, I'm glad you read the passage.
Let me turn the question on you, because something I sense, namely students are confronted with certain selling propositions on part of their teachers. Now, there are teachers, as their selling proposition, they come up with a Wittgensteinian ideal, namely we as philosophers are remote from modern technology, we are reflective and are up in the mountains. So part of the students are attracted to this ideal. And then another selling proposition is, look, if you go and study philosophy, you will participate in the most exciting new experiments in XML. So that's a second selling proposition. And now you are torn between those two, and it's been legitimate, of course, but how do you make ends meet?
I mean, I think my question was something I could think, but I don't think that it's my opinion always. So I think that we have to, I mean, in real life, we have to make a kind of synthesis out of this contradiction. I mean, I have to agree, basically, that this is necessary because it's reality requires that from us. So I think we, in this way, we have to be realistic. But I think Wittgenstein also implies that we never have to forget the ideal. I mean, what we are really striving for, and this indeed is clarity, and not the growth of information.
I'd like to sort of like bridge a little bit between what's being said and also that comment before. We're sort of adding in some ways some themes to what you mentioned. I think in my view another theme that is going through is a very contemporary theme, at least in part because when I hear information society, I hear, just because of my job, I hear techno-science, knowledge-based political economy. And I hear, you know, some kind of resonances in this meeting on issues of the changing role of science, not just as an advisory force, but on issues, but as a force or agency in defining what the issues are that matter. That is, to just say that again, science is very much changing, foundational science is changing in really fundamental ways. We're not, you know, when philosophers are debating contexts of, you know, context of discovery, context of testing. I will live in a world where we talk about context of application. And we all know we're living, and that was a mention of your stuff on GM crops, GMO stuff, nuclear energy, and all those other kind of things. Science is advising on citizenship and so on and so forth. To repeat my sentence, science is advising, or whatever we're calling knowledge economy, or whatever here, is not just advising on issues, but saying what the issues are that matter, what is important, okay? And that relates back to what is being discussed here on this two-way kind of thing. Why some confusion is going on there is that it's as though we've already know what matters. Risk matters, okay, taking risks and making money and avoiding other risks. So I think that a lot of a lot of the issues are here maybe not so much a polarization of progress or clarity. Clarity is being called for, and perhaps interesting, because I'm going to be killed now. Clarity is being called for because people want to think about what matters in a certain sense, and I think that that's something that's take back. That's all I'm saying.
I agree so deeply with you, among other things, because I don't believe the problem is Wittgenstein, or is Wittgenstein here or not. The problem is philosophy. And that's why I said before that Wittgenstein is just the instance of this thing. Now, there are, I think, two populations here. One is more scientifically oriented, and the other is more philosophically oriented. And, of course, there are philosophies of science, etc. I mean, people mix and links go back and forth, and we all pretend to know the other side well. The point is that search for clarity that Newton was looking for, as he said and as he was taken to task a bit, for him that was a moral undertaking. And there was that whole problematics of, for Wittgenstein, was it monkish or not, etc. But deciding that you are going to ask what matters rather than to go automatically with what has become the presupposition of what matters, I think, is the philosophical question, which is not to say that there aren't important scientific questions and that we shouldn't be talking to each other. But I think the question of clarity, if it's important in more than a Wittgensteinian way of just clarity for clarity's sake, is clarity so that we can write books like the book that Newton is writing.
Yeah, if we take the notion as of meaning as use seriously, I think it's also very difficult to talk about what philosophy should do, because there are so many philosophies, so many conceptions. You can regard philosophy as a kind of problem solving, specific philosophical problems. You can see it as a kind Hegelian way of trying to understand the time in which you live, which is also, I think, a very important notion. What is happening around us? Ein Blick in das, was ist, to call it with a phrase of Heidegger. You might also think of clarification in the Wittgensteinian sense. There are so many different conceptions, and I think they all can, in one way, or and perhaps also what is important, it's a bit narcissistic, theoretically narcissistic in a sense, is that philosophers also should think what happens with philosophy because of information technologies. Because the whole when you say philosophy is an activity, this activity is also changing. It's not the same activity as in the time Wittgenstein was doing philosophy. So I think these are all important questions, and it's not a question that we have to choose one of them as the best one, I think.
But doesn't it just go back to the question, what matters? I mean, isn't that the ultimate question, in a sense?
Yeah, but I think that many things matter. Hmm?
I'm tempted to make some puns on matter, but I don't think it matters. But a quick comment. Yeah, never mind. A quick comment. I hope that people heard in Chris Chesser's lecture and at least overtones of the same thing in mine, that as we ask the question of what matters, one of the things that, at least for me, is very clear now, is that the way we ask the question and respond to that question is very deeply shaded by the technologies of communication that we use to do so. And so I would ask us to be very self-reflective about how the information technologies that we're using are reshaping our approaches to these fundamental questions. I'm not trying to give up on the questions, but I want to be self-aware as to how the technologies of communication affect our responses and ideas.
So my question is this, and it's addressed to all the participants, as I said. In the title of the panel discussion is Information Society. So let me ask all of you, which exact model of a society or of a social life or collective life would you prefer or would you like to use or you use now? And the second one is related. Sometimes, it's pretty often actually, the term Information Society is connected to the term of modernity or modernization or something related to that. And it's very similar. What model of modernity would you use? Would you prefer? The third one is also similar. What model of information society would you use? We know a lot of information now after a pretty long discussion about that, but we still don't know exactly what model of information society we need or we like to use and why it's important.
I'll be the sacrificial lamb and babble a little bit while my colleagues have time to think. My first response to the idea of the information society is that it's a vast oversimplification driven by economic and political interests, and that we have to be aware of it, take it seriously. It has some benefits, some not so benefits. I don't have a model for it. I think that model is emerging. What I would want to suggest about information comes from a very different orientation than we've heard here. I would recommend the work, among others, of Albert Borgmann, who wrote a book in 1998 or 99 called Holding On to Reality. And he makes a distinction between natural information, cultural information, and digital information, which is a useful distinction to make for my purposes, which is my fear in the information society is that we all too easily are seduced into believing everything can be digitized. I want to hold on to notions of embodiment. I want to hold on to notions of irreducible differences between cultures and individuals that cannot be ultimately reduced into something saleable or commodified through a digital pipe. I'm sorry that Barbara Becker is not here, because I think her work is also something that I would recommend in terms of the importance of touch and resonance in human relationships that I fear gets lost in much of our thinking about the information society. The challenges for philosophy, from my perspective, as I mentioned already, I'm not sure that we are as reflective about our communication technologies as we should be. And as you heard this morning, I think we should be highly reflective about the role of culture in shaping our views, which perhaps we already are. It is a little odd for an American to come to Europeans and say, you should be thinking about culture. And I hope I've managed to give enough cover to my colleagues now so they can provide better responses.
There is one.
I would like only to respond to the second question about the challenges. I think from a philosophical point of view, at least, my point of view, a very interesting question is about the controllability of technological developments. In Antigone of Sophocles, there is a very famous Stasimon, the first Stasimon, the choir, it's called the Ode of Man, and it sketches all the wonders of technology. And I think the English translation of Jeb begins of there are many wonders, but nothing is as wondrous as man. I think this is the beginning of it. And then it sketches the way human beings invented agriculture, invented language, invented a society, invented all kinds of technologies. But it ends very ominous in the sense that he cannot control that very thing that drives them. And I think this is a very important question, especially in the age of information technology. I'm not very fond of Heidegger's philosophy of technology, but there is one thing, one sentence I often have to think about, and I think that's a very frightening question in a certain sense. And he says, well, man, we think that as humans we control technology, but in a certain sense, technology controls us. And he says, for a long time, technology has control over all kinds of things. But in this age, he says, we're becoming the ultimate object of technology. And he's thinking, for example, about genetic engineering and those kind of things. And you can think of things as a genetic divide, people who will all kind of genetic amendments, or how do you call it? And others not. So I think this is for philosophers also a very important topic to think about, because we are often inclined to think and in terms of, well, there are problems and we have to find a solution. But are we able to do so? And there is and that was the reason I referred to Sophocles. There is a kind of tragic dimension in technology. On the one hand, it gives us, it empowers us enormously, and on the other hand, it's something that also threatens to destroy us in a certain way. And that can be on an individual's level or on the level of certain populations or humankind itself, in a way.
I agree with the last comment. I just want to point out that the translation, nothing as wonderful as man, is the word wonderful is meant in the sense of wonderful or awe-full. The Greek word is xenos, meaning strange or weird or thought-provoking.
Short one?
In the Greek, it's deinon. And deinon is very difficult to translate. For example, Hölderlin translated as unheimlich. And that's quite something different than wondrous, of course. And that means it's very interesting, because deinon in Greek is a very ambivalent term. And it's used in two senses. When you regard it to things, to non-human things, it is about dangerous things. Storms and that kind of things are deinon. Used with humans, it's often very positive. Somebody who is deinon is very brave, for example, in the war. And the brilliant thing of this sentence in Sophocles is that he combines them, because he says many things are deinon, and everybody thinks, woo, this is very dangerous, and it becomes very dangerous. And then he says, nothing is as deinon as human beings. So he combines those two contrary meanings. This is very difficult for some theories of truth, I'm afraid. Those meanings in one ambivalent statement.
We had in the workshop, we had sort of a pre-panel discussion warm-up, and this is actually directed to you. It seems to me that there's another technology is a human tool. I think maybe we can agree upon that. And there's one tool that humans have had for a while, and it's one reason we call them humans, and it's called language. And I think when we start talking about technology and human creation, things that humans create, it's very easy to demonize them in a sense or talk about them away, but there's a symbiotic relation, I'd say, between humans and their language. And is language something, I mean, if you're going to demonize computer technology or certain other forms of human technology, then why not start with language? I mean, look at all the troubles it's gotten into, but it's also helped us a lot.
I think it was of Burroughs that he said language is a virus from outer space. So might be, yeah. Well, what I think is interesting of the Greek notion of techne, because there it's all about, is the ambivalence. Because it's not demonizing it, because it's both. And in Sophocles' Ode to Man is really, there's a lot of admiration expressed in this. But the very point is that it's ambivalent. And that at the same something which in a certain sense gives us a very special place in nature. Perhaps we are the first species that will construct its evolutionary. That is something very wondrous in the sense jeopardy to it. And at the same time, it's something which is very unheimlich, to take the Hölderlin translation.
Two short questions which are nearly connected. First question, I would suggest a little bit more discussion about those people who won't use IT technologies for the next decades. And what about the gap between the population that are users and those that are non-users? I think that's a real social problem. And the second dependency, just compare with the motor cars. We would never have thought at the first cars about the huge problems, air pollution, death, environmental damage, and the dependency as well as the damages are coming up much, much quicker with IT technologies.
I want to connect to the question before, and I hope I get, I hope it becomes applicable to what you just said. When you said we are the first species that's going to see something or other, and you didn't finish the sentence, and I thought, wow, well, maybe we're the first species that's going to work out our own demise, too.
Yeah.
And I think for every thought I have about technology, every intuition I have a contrary one immediately, and that goes with what you were saying too. You know, we're talking about this great digital turn, but immediately we have to think about those who are not part of it. And I'd like to just spell out a thought and its contrary. One is, of course, the old, age-old, maybe it's not that age-old, fact-value distinction, which says, on the one hand, we can notice information, technology, facts, cognition, and on the other, there's our ethical decisions as to what we do with language or with the tools. And that's one of the things that we were brought up on, at least those of us who did a certain very regular modernistic kind of philosophical education. So here's the information, here's the technology, and then it's a different question altogether what we do with it. That's one thought. The contrary thought that I always think of is, first of all, that the fact-value distinction has now been under a lot of attack by very, very, very persuasive philosophers. And when I look today at technology, and I think of a certain ethics arising from the praxis. In other words, I can't separate the ethics so cleanly and so unequivocally from the technology. This connects with what Charles was saying right from the beginning. And so the only thing I can say, I think, is that since this is something big, it's a conceptual revolution. In my sense, it might be less so in some other people's sense, but everybody sees that something's happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear, but maybe a conceptual revolution doesn't entail ethical statements or ethical positions, but it does involve them and it does demand of us something. So I can't formulate the logic that will bring me from the technology to a certain ethics, but I have to do something about it rather than stay indifferent or stay just on that part of, okay, let's continue with this great development.
If I could answer two questions sort of at once, I'd like to step back to your comment about language and gently reiterate. This is why in communication studies, but I think philosophers would do well to pay attention to it. We go back to Innes, Eisenstein, McLuhan, and Ong, and they begin with the notion that language is a communication technology, and that different ways of using language can be understood as technologies affiliated with certain social stages and so forth. It's not a perfect theory. It has a number of flaws and deficits, but it does help us think about ICTs and without wanting to demonize them, because what you'll see after this panel is all of us are going to be up at Mama's yet once again checking our email. Walter Ong has said what we are moving towards is something he's called the secondary orality of cyberspace, moving back to a kind of tribal notion of communication, which is kind of interesting but also not very democratic. And I would posit that as a worry, not a demonization, but as a worry. That's actually affiliated with your question about the digital divide. As far as I can tell, ICTs... ICTs have worked as social amplifiers, social and political amplifiers. You can find some very nice examples when the technology is new, where marginalized groups in religion or politics or whatever manage to get online real quick and exploit the technology and do wonderful things. and then they are pushed out or pushed to the margins yet again by those who already have power. This has happened in politics, and it's happened in economics. By every measure I have been able to look at, the gap between the rich and the poor in every developed country is increasing, and the gap between rich and poor between north and south is increasing. It's not just ICTs, but ICTs are an engine of globalization. And so it is an enormous problem. And at that point, I slipped from my usual American optimism. I like those examples where ICTs empower women in Jordan or whatever. But as far as I can tell, those are the exceptions to a larger tendency.
Yeah, I wonder whether I may add a few comments. And again, I'll try to be as short as possible, quickly. About the conceptual revolution, I think that what happens, it seems to me that there's a widespread impression that something is happening, but of course at the same time a quite big lack of understanding of what precisely is happening. So allow me to offer some sort of metaphor. What's happening, seems to me, is something along the following lines. Is when you move house. Now, philosophy is moving house. In the new house, you find almost the same furniture, but not quite. It doesn't fit in the same way as you fitted so well in the previous house. You need to buy some new furniture, new problems, new issues. The kitchen is almost the same, but the fridge is in a completely different position. In fact, it's a new fridge. Now, the new house is almost like the previous one, but not quite. There are new issues, new methods, new problems. So you're going to do some new acquaintance with the new scenario. It's normal to be disoriented. I think it's useful to try to overstep the idea something is happening and try to say, okay, what is happening? Now, here comes my second suggestion, and I hope it's not going to be too demanding in terms of time. There are many ways of doing philosophy. I mean, anyone here knows it. And it's not useful to be reminded. Thank you. It's important to know, but we can overstep that. You need to have a vision of what kind of good philosophy is going to be useful in the new house. In the new house, what is important, what might be useful, is to do some conceptual engineering. So allow me this sort of big step historically. We like to divide medieval philosophy, modern philosophy, thanks to Descartes, and we like to divide modern philosophy, contemporary philosophy, thanks to Wittgenstein, two engineers. It would be nice to have some sort of equal threshold between what we've done so far and what we can do in the future. Again, conceptual engineering, the idea of constructing concepts that can help us to understand our society. And because it's a new environment, what we might want to think, and that's the third last suggestion, is some sort of environmental approach to this new environment. It's quite simple. It's not groundbreaking. We've been doing environmental philosophy for a long while. We've just been pushing the barrier of what environmental philosophy means, not only humans, not only animals, not only the forest, not only whole ecosystems, but also something more, the constructed, the artifacts. We just have to make the last step. We need to consider also what we are building, the whole house, as it were, including the digital, including the artifacts. Now, if we can make this last step, then we have a vision, and then we know what we're doing. Then we can go step and say, okay, in 100 years, someone will tell us that we were wrong. But let's do it first, so that with that self-consciousness that philosophers always have, oh my God, I'm going to do something and someone will come next year and will say, oh, that's so last year. Do it first and be criticized afterwards.
I have a very simple comment to Luciano's metaphor, which I liked enormously. When you move house, one of the most beneficial aspects of moving house is throwing away a lot of baggage. I would invite philosophers, I'm not a professional philosopher, fortunately, to follow this part of the metaphor as well and reorganize things and reduce baggage. Thank you.
I think that it might help around about baggage or whatever. I mean, just sort of continuing this what matters kind of thing and the point you're making about environment, okay, and my insistence on technoscience and so on. I think technology, technoscience is science-driven technology. It's something we've we may not have seen before the atomic bomb. And there are new, that's where the, you know, the environmental and the nuclear comes from. It's happy that a biologist probably can speak very, very closely to this. I recognize him here. Here's where we come back to this kind of question of philosophy and what matters. So I think that some of these kind of things of some kind of, and I'm really applauding your observation on putting down some baggage, because you're going to have to put some that baggage down to hold on to the really new concepts in science going on.